Friday, November 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, tensions escalate between Britain and France after the death of dozens of migrants crossing the English Channel.
This has been an argument that's been brewing for several months, mostly over those crossings of the small boats, which have increased significantly.
Al-Shabaab militants claim responsibility for a suicide attack on a UN convoy in Mogadishu.
Al-Shabaab spokesman told Reuters news agency the suicide car bombing Thursday was aimed at UN security convoy.
And BioNTech turns its attention to cancer treatment after the success of its COVID-19 vaccine. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says the European Union must be prepared to enact more sanctions against Russia if the situation in and around eastern Ukraine or on the Belarus-Poland border escalates. Speaking at a joint news conference in Berlin Thursday with her Polish counterpart, Mateusz Morawiecki, the outgoing chancellor, says the EU had to be united on the issue of Belarus's weaponization, quote, of migrants against Poland and Russia's deployment of troops to near its border with Ukraine. She said, quote, any further aggression against the sovereignty of Ukraine will carry a heavy price, unquote, adding that defusing the situation should always be the preferred option. Morawiecki told reporters on the migrant crisis with Belarus that Poland would not, quote, give in to political blackmail, unquote. He added that his country has defended the European Union's outer borders and therefore his country is also defending Germany against a large wave of migrants. Merkel praised Poland's calm handling of the border crisis and told reporters that she has expressed Germany's full solidarity to the Polish Prime Minister. The deaths of over 2 dozen migrants in the English Channel is fueling tensions between the UK and France over how to stop migrants from crossing the world's busiest waterway in small boats. London blames Paris for not doing enough to deter illegal crossings in unsafe dinghy boats. French authorities deny the charge and blame British officials for failing to pay an agreed fund to increase patrols on the Channel. For more on the growing spat, I spoke with reporter Henry Ridgewell.
The latest we have from the French authorities, which is where the bodies and the survivors were taken, is that there were 27 deaths on board this boat on Wednesday. There were 17 men, 7 women, and very tragically, 3 children who died. There are also 2 survivors, it's understood. They are being treated for severe hypothermia in French hospitals.
And the blame game has started, finger pointing between Paris and London. What is going on with this relationship?
This has been an argument that's been brewing for several months, mostly over those crossings of the small boats, which have increased significantly in the past 2 years. Just in 2018, there were virtually no traffic of these small boats carrying migrants across the English Channel. But then what we saw was a very sharp tightening up of security around the traditional methods that the migrants and the people smugglers had used to get people into Britain via either lorries crossing on ferries or on the Channel Tunnel on the rail link or through other means, through railways or through aeroplanes as well. And that security tightening meant that the only option left was for people to start using these small boats. And the smuggling gangs made a trade of this. It started at quite small level. I've been down to the beaches of southern England where these boats have been landing over the past couple of years. And the speed with which it has increased this year is extraordinary. Now triple the number, more than 25,000 migrants arriving on these small inflatable boats over 2021. That's triple the number from last year. The British government has tried to cooperate with the French authorities. They came to an agreement earlier this year whereby Britain would give around $75 million to the French government to increase their patrols and to invest in new surveillance equipment along the French coastline. But the boats have kept on coming, and that's where the blame game has begun, really. Britain has said that France isn't doing enough, firstly, to stop the boats departing from the French coastline. It's saying there should be more patrols, and also that it's not doing enough to break the smuggling gangs and to arrest those responsible. Now, in this particular tragic incident from Wednesday, we understand that French police have made 4 arrests of people that they believe were involved in the passage of this particular boat yesterday close to Dunkirk. And the British point is, well, if those arrests were made in the last few hours, why couldn't those arrests have been made previously in previous weeks, and we would have avoided prompted this tragedy, and Britain claims that France should be doing a lot more, since this is where most of the migrants base themselves as a departure point to come to Britain. Now, the French perspective is that Britain has got to do something about it being such a magnet for these migrants to get to. It's variously blamed the labour laws in this country, which migrants seem to find very attractive. They believe they can get a job here. France also wants Britain to pay up on its contract. Now, we believe that £75 million that Britain had promised France has not yet been fully paid, so they want that money up front as well. And behind all of this is the brewing tensions over Brexit as well, which has obviously been going on for 5 years now, over tensions over Northern Ireland, over fishing rights in those same waters in the English Channel as well. So this is a human tragedy that is also becoming a political crisis, really, between Britain and France.
With this tragedy, it's obvious whatever deterrence measures they have in place is not working. Are they thinking of reviewing it, and how would they go about it?
The latest proposal from Britain, one that was offered earlier in the year as well, is for joint British and French patrols along the French coastline to stop these boats departing. That would see a significant increase in the number of officers, security officers patrolling. It would be new surveillance equipment, infrared equipment, drones, offshore patrols in boats to intercept the migrants before they got very far offshore. Now, in practice, that sounds like it might work, but when you take into account the length of the French coastline, so it's not just that Dover-Calais route, which is the narrowest point of the English Channel that they're using. These migrants are departing on a vast stretch of the French coastline, something like 200 kilometres in the dead of night as well. Under the cover of night, they're being given the boats by the smugglers. They get offshore quietly before they start the outboard motors, and then they try and get across the channel.
That's reporter Henry Ridwell speaking with me from London. As tension escalates, a spokesman for French fishermen said they will block the Channel Tunnel and the port of Calais on Friday in protest over what Britain's post-Brexit fishing license policy. Members of the Fishermen's Association told an online news conference on Thursday that lots of vehicles will be used to block up the Channel Tunnel, adding that they considered they had been too patient for too long. France and Britain have for months been at loggerheads over the number of licenses London allocated to French fishing boats after Britain left the European Union. France and its fishermen say many are missing, while London says it is respecting the deal. The United Arab Emirates has held talks with the Taliban to run Kabul airport, going up against Gulf rivals Qatar and Turkey in a diplomatic tussle for influence with Afghan's new rulers. Kabul airport serves as landlocked Afghanistan's main air link to the world. Analysts say the influence of the UAE as a possible bridge to Western support and funds could be responsible for the Taliban's choice of the oil-rich nation. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gaur.
We know UAE obviously has a rivalry with Qatar. There has been tension in the relationship. So that makes sense. You know, on the face of it, one can say that UAE is interested and wants to come back to Afghanistan, because we know that UAE was one of the three countries that had recognized the previous Taliban government in the 1990s and has had good relationship with the Taliban for a long time. But let me just emphasize here that whatever role Qatar has played in terms of facilitating the Taliban's role, Taliban's negotiations with the United States, and currently the way Qatar is campaigning to encourage the international community to engage with the Taliban, to help the Taliban, that gives Qatar a lot of leverage in terms of influence over the Taliban. So it will be very challenging for the UAE to regain some kind of concession or gain concession from the Taliban, whether it's running the airport in Kabul. So the reason why Turkey has not been able to get what it really promised and wanted to do, and why Qatar is still stepping back and not really actively seeking control for the Kabul airport, and even if UAE wants to do it, it is practically not possible under the circumstances because of the sanctions that have been imposed on the Taliban since they took control of Afghanistan in August. Economic sanctions, banking sector has been almost choked. So with no possibility of no financial transactions and no banking system, any country that would want to have some kind of a cooperative deal with the Taliban to run any kind of system in Afghanistan would require some kind of a banking facility between Afghanistan and the rest of the world to facilitate.
Could the UAE be a deal breaker in trying to reconnect the Taliban to the international community, and of course, not just around the airport, but maybe other major infrastructure.
Because UAE is an ally of Saudi Arabia, and Taliban have a lot of respect for Saudi Arabia, and with these two countries, they have had good relationship in the past. So obviously, Saudi's connection with the United States and then Saudi's influence over UAE could collectively produce a situation where they can try to connect or reconnect the Taliban with the rest of the world. But that will be really a situation where Qatar will try to discourage it from happening, because Qatar has been hosting the Taliban's political office since 2013. Qatar has done so much at the international stage. You know, it was criticized for hosting the Taliban in their country. And Qatar has never allowed any other country to take away this diplomatic initiative that they had in place to bring the war in Afghanistan to an end through these negotiations between the US and the Taliban. So it will be upsetting for Qatar to allow this diplomatic initiative that to be taken away by any other country. So we will see a lot of tension and rivalry in that situation. But right now, I think Qatar has stepped back for obvious reasons that they don't want to upset the United States. Anyone, neighboring countries do not want to do that. They're just waiting. It's a wait and see policy that these countries have adopted. But once real things start happening, that if the Taliban get some kind of recognition or there is a connection between the international community and the Taliban, that will be the time when we will see a lot of rivalry taking place between these regional countries, because everybody really wants to maintain their influence, especially the regional countries, over the Taliban and inside Afghanistan for their vested interests.
How important is this Kabul airport?
Well, this is extremely important because we know that as per the United Nations warnings that Afghanistan, like 60% of the population of Afghanistan, is in dire need of urgent humanitarian assistance. And we also know that the United Nations and international aid agencies are working in Afghanistan. And then there are foreign nationals associated with these welfare projects in Afghanistan. So in order to sustain this humanitarian effort to make sure that these millions of Afghans who are threatened with starvation really are facilitated and aid is brought to them, that's number one, that the humanitarian sustenance of humanitarian aid is key, because if anything bad starts happening, like if people start dying because of the starvation that they're facing, I think West will come under a lot of criticism. So at least an effort is being made through regional and neighboring countries that this Kabul airport, which is the only link between the world and Afghanistan, functions smoothly, and so that a humanitarian assistance can be flown into Afghanistan.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gao speaking with me from Islamabad. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says nearly 80 people have been murdered this year in a detention camp in northeastern Syria, holding the wives and children of Islamic State fighters. Camp authorities say the IS wives ruled the Ahor camp with violence as they tried to keep the group active years after their defeat. VOA said the murderers visited the Ahor and Al-Raj detention camps and filed this report.
We are told not to go inside this market here in Al-Hol, a detention center in northeastern Syria holding tens of thousands of women and children of defeated Islamic State fighters. Authorities say some of the extremist families here are armed, and there have been as many as 79 murders so far this year. They suspect militants on the outside are smuggling in weapons, and that the murders are mostly punishments doled out by the self-declared IS religious police inside the camp. Despite ongoing security operations against IS in and around Al-Hol, there are still monthly killings, according to the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces running the camp.
Several days ago, some journalists went to the camp and IS children threw stones at them. IS women enforce the IS laws, and women who break these laws are killed.
Most of the detained women and children are from Syria or Iraq, but there are also women from 57 other countries. The United Nations has called on those countries to repatriate their citizens from Al-Hol and Al-Raj, another northeastern Syrian detention camp for women and children associated with IS. Al-Raj is considered less extremist and less violent, But even here, children throw rocks and bits of glass bottles at visiting foreigners, and 16 tents were burnt down last month. Women in Al Raj who choose to speak to reporters have one overwhelming message. They want to go home.
I do not want other people to make the mistakes I did by coming to Syria, bringing my children and getting them killed. I regret so much. I still hope we can go to France and have hope for my children.
Off camera, women in Al-Hol tell us about harsh living conditions and also complain that boys between 12 to 14 years old are taken from their mothers and kept elsewhere in an effort to de-radicalize them. Most of the women and children in these camps surrendered in 2019 as IS lost its last bit of territory after controlling vast swaths of Iraq and Syria for years. Since then, local authorities have pleaded with the international community for help, saying the camps and other makeshift detention centers holding uncharged men, women, and children are ticking time bombs of extremism. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, at the Al-Hol and Al-Raj camps in Syria.
Al-Shabaab terrorists in Somalia have claimed responsibility for a suicide attack on a UN convoy in the capital Mogadishu Thursday during morning rush hour that killed at least 8 people and wounded 17. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu.
Al-Shabaab spokesman told Reuters news agency the suicide car bombing Thursday was aimed at UN security convoy. It was not immediately clear if any UN staff were among the casualties, but Somali police spokesman Abdelfattah Aden Hassan confirmed the UN convoy was the target. Hassan told state media Radio Mogadishu that the attack was near several schools. The Associated Press reported several students among the victims. Hassan said they were limited as schools were already on weekend break. He says most casualties were small business owners and passerby in the area since there were no lessons for students today. At least one school appeared damaged by the blast, with social media images showing a blown-out classroom and debris scattered across the desks. The U.S. Embassy in Mogadishu strongly condemned the attack in a tweet, saying the people of Somalia deserve to live without fear of attack. The Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab carries out frequent attacks in Somalia with aim of overthrowing the government. Mohamed Kahi for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
The growing number of protesters' deaths are hardening Sudanese resolve against the military. David Doyle of Reuters reports that one Mohammed Abdesalam says his 18-year-old son, Mido, was, quote, his backbone, unquote. Last month, he was killed as he protested a military takeover in Sudan, one of 42 such fatalities.
Mohammed Abdesalam had been planning to help his son emigrate from Sudan to Saudi Arabia. Instead, 18-year-old Mido was shot and fatally wounded as he protested against a takeover by Sudan's military last month.
My son took a fatal blow to the chest, and the forces who were there, whether the military or the central security forces by the bridge, were firing live rounds and tear gas. None of the protesters were carrying weapons or firing. Yes, there were protesters, but it's their right to do so. If they had fired weapons, I would understand. But these were youths at the beginning of their lives, and he was my backbone.
This was Mido's funeral procession. He's one of 42 people, according to medics aligned with the protest movement, to have been killed in demonstrations against the coup. Many of the dead were teenagers like him, or in their 20s. The youngest was a 13-year-old girl. Police have acknowledged a single protester death and have denied firing live rounds. Security forces could not be reached for comment. But the toll has hardened opinion against security forces, already blamed for protester deaths in the uprising that ousted autocrat Omar al-Bashir in 2019. Many, like Abdesalam, also reject a deal signed on Sunday that reinstated civilian Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok.
This deal that was recently signed doesn't represent anything to the Sudanese people, because we want a civilian government. This deal is nothing more than a ruse. The military is still in their place. Our sons who died for the sake of a civilian and democratic government. This deal is completely rejected.
Protest leaders have vowed an escalation of civil unrest until the military is completely removed from power. On Thursday, they were marching again. This time under the slogan, Loyalty to the Martyrs.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. African health officials say the pace of COVID-19 vaccinations has slowed on the continent, raising concerns about stopping the pandemic. They are calling on Africans to get inoculated as soon as support arrives through the COVID vaccine sharing initiative, which aims for equitable global access. The World Health Organization African region also is warning people against lowering their guard during this festive period. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi.
Speaking at a virtual press briefing Thursday, John Kengasong, director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said the number of Africans seeking COVID-19 vaccinations has gone down.
Only 55% of vaccines that have arrived have actually been used now on the continent. That is really an acceptable situation because of the distribution. Okay, and which means if people have wanted to be vaccinated, they can be vaccinated. And I'm really making an appeal. I know I've said this over and over for everyone on the continent who can who have access to vaccines to go get their vaccines. And that is the only way that we can protect ourselves.
The continent's health agency says the slow pace of inoculations is not about hesitancy or lack of vaccine, but moving the vaccine from the airport to people's arms. So far, Africa has vaccinated 10% of its population and received 330 million doses from COVAX, the UN-backed global initiative to distribute shots to low- and middle-income countries. Africa has a population of 1.3 billion people. Richard Mihigo is a program coordinator with the World Health Organization's Immunization and Vaccine Development Program.
It's a very good news that we have now more supply. Now we are trying to make sure that the country are getting ready. They are even diversifying their strategy in reaching out not only vulnerable population, but we have seen also countries that have opened up vaccination even to children between 12 years and above.
Kenya has witnessed slow action on COVID-19 vaccinations. This week, authorities threatened to cut off government services to unvaccinated individuals. Machidiso Moeti, the WHO's regional director for Africa, says the population needs to be careful as people prepare for the December holidays.
We're already seeing an uptick in new cases in Southern Africa, with a 48% jump in new cases compared with the preceding week. This comes after 18 weeks of sustained decline, with the increase driven mainly by a spike in cases in South Africa. We know that vaccination is our best defense. But while many high-income countries report more than 60% vaccine coverage, just over 7% of Africa's population is fully vaccinated.
Botswana and South Africa have reported a new coronavirus variant, B11529, which is believed to be highly transmittable and vaccine-resistant. A WHO analysis shows only 27% of African health workers are fully vaccinated, leaving many medical workers unprotected. Africa has recorded more than 8.6 million coronavirus cases and 221 deaths from the resulting COVID-19 illness. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
In other news, at least 14 people died in a fire at a coal mine in Russia's Siberia region on Thursday that also left 35 others missing and feared dead. Authorities say 11 miners were found dead and 3 rescuers also died later while searching for others who were trapped at a remote section of the mine. Regional officials declared 3 days of mourning for the victims. Efforts to rescue those trapped in the mine about 200 meters underground were halted on Thursday because of an explosion threat, and rescuers were rushed out of the mine. The NFR News agency reported that miners have oxygen supplies normally lasting for 6 hours that could be stretched for a few more hours, but would have expired by late Thursday. Nearly 50 other miners were injured. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. The goal of the BioNTech company was to find a cure for cancer, but the whole world recognized them for developing the first vaccine against the coronavirus. The founders of the corporation, Ongar Sahin and Özlem Türeci, now turn their attention back to cancer. VOA's Dilger Timochin interviewed Ongar Sahin and filed this report.
Uğur Şahin and Özlem Türeci made history by developing the BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine. Now they are returning to their previous work, finding a cure for cancer. BioNTech is working to develop a new cancer treatment using the same mRNA technology that was used to develop the COVID-19 vaccine. Shaheen, who was in Washington, D.C. for a scientific panel on cancer treatment, intends to break new ground by merging mRNA with CAR T cell therapy normally used to treat blood malignancies. Their goal is to merge these two technologies and create a cancer treatment that targets solid tumors.
So there is not yet great evidence that CAR T cells work in solid tumors, but we believe that the combination of the right target plus the vaccine could help to overcome this limitation.
The CAR T treatment entails removing T cells from patients, genetically modifying them to target cancer, and then reintroducing them into the patient's body to attack the tumor. Shaheen says he's after Claudin 6 protein. His research is currently underway to combine CAR T cell therapy with a vaccination to increase the body's ability to produce CAR T cells and increase the amount of time they can fight cancer in the body.
The Claudin 6 is on tumor cells, yeah? And we have on the T cells a receptor, CAR T cell receptor, which recognizes Claudin 6. If these CAR T cells are infused, they recognize and kill tumor cells, but at a certain time they stop to grow.
The problem that may arise in CAR T cell therapy is toxicity. Medical experts say it can cause cytokine release syndrome with severe inflammation and brain swelling and can be fatal. In healthy cells, the absence of the Claudin 6 protein targeted in BioNTech's therapy appears to minimize this risk, say researchers. Shaheen says the goal isn't just to shrink the tumor, it's also to make sure it doesn't come back. Although Shaheen doesn't specify the precise number of patients in the study, but says the number is between 20 to 25. Their patient selection depends on whether the target Claudin 6 is expressed on tumor cells.
This is testicular cancer, this is ovarian cancer, these are patients with endometrial cancer, uterine cancer. We are also including patients with sarcomas, soft tissue sarcomas, and we had also a patient with a rare breast cancer type, but this are less frequent.
At the annual meetings of the Society for Immunotherapy of Cancer in Washington, D.C., Uğur Şahin presented some very early data from clinical studies. According to Shaheen, the treatment typically takes 3 to 4 years to reach the market. While previous CAR T cell treatments in the United States cost roughly $400,000, it's difficult to predict how much BioNTech's treatment will cost if it's approved in the future. Dilge Timochin, VOA News, Washington.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington, wishing you a wonderful day.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba-ba-ba-zip.